You're listening to the Peter Ryan Report on Coinspice.io. You're listening to the Peter Ryan Report to the Peter Ryan Coinspice.io.
Episode of the Peter Ryan Report on CoinSpice. This is episode 7, and this time around we're going to take on a non-controversial, as we always do, easy subject, which of course is the specter of Hong Kong protests. And they are ongoing, as they have now for a couple of weeks. And there's a lot of gold to mine from these occurrences. And who better to talk to than one of the most interesting thinkers in the space, Mr. Peter Ryan. Thanks again for coming back on, man.
Yeah, happy to be here. And there might be some Bitcoin to mine out in Hong Kong as well.
Boom. Yeah, so for listeners who may not be completely up to speed on what's going on, Hong Kong, of course, is part of communist China, but in a way it isn't. It's its own sort of island, its own sort of oasis of capitalist activity as a holdover from British colonial rule. And so there's always been kind of a weird tension since the UK gave it back to China formally over the last few years, as to China wanting, sort of communist China, mainland China, wanting to, you know, hold on to the goose that's laying the golden egg, and then at the same time kind of spread the good news of Maoist of the Maoist legacy. And then there are just these tensions that can't seem to resolve themselves, and they have more recently spilled out into the street, which is very unusual for the Chinese generally to do, just because they're such headcrackers over there in terms of the government. And it happened over an extradition bill, and we'll get into the particulars of that. But what just kind of, if we do, if you sort of pull back and look at the broad scope of seeing this massive of people, last I heard there was like 1 in 7 Hong Kongers, so that's like 1 million people have taken to the streets every other weekend or so. What's your hot take? What's your back of the envelope take?
So my hot take is that this is a very interesting time for Bitcoin. And I say that because this might not seem like a Bitcoin-related incident at first, or even a financial-related incident. This protest is mainly to do about a legal extradition treaty where, you know, people in Hong Kong can get, you know, sent out to mainland China, you know, for various reasons that they're not too happy with, and they want to protect their sovereignty and their freedom. But the thing is, why this is interesting for Bitcoin is that the people in Hong Kong are realizing that this whole integration with mainland China, while we're, you know, have a years upon years of sort of free market history, and mainland with its history of communism, do not gel together very well. And so if this extradition treaty is just the tip of the iceberg for what's down the pike, you know, we need to start thinking about how we protect our freedom in a multitude of ways. And financial freedom is, of course, part of that. And so with the rise of cracking skulls, of protest, of extradition treaties, and, you know, other government overreaches, people in Hong Kong are thinking about, hey, I need to get my money out. I need to think about, how do I protect my wealth and, you know, move it out of the claws, or the shadow of the claws of the communist Chinese government. And so that's where Bitcoin is a great tool that comes in order for these people to get on, transfer their Hong Kong dollars or whatever they're using, and park it in Bitcoin or use Bitcoin as a vehicle to sort of anonymously get it away and then convert out and park it in some US equity or some real estate, whatever it might be. And Bitcoin is the tool for that. It's a great way to sort of really jump out and, you know, not go through all the KYC and all the other tracking that goes on, especially when it comes to the Chinese government, which even though there's differences between Hong Kong and the Chinese system, you know, in general, the Chinese government does not want people, you know, fleeing with capital anymore. You know, they want to lock that investment down, no matter if you're a billionaire or if you're just like someone in the middle class. They want to make sure that that money stays in the country. And so Bitcoin gives, yeah, that life raft to a lot of people that can pop out and don't have to go by the legacy systems that can be co-opted by the state.
And I think people's analysts, so far as I've been able to reckon, have really downplayed or really not played at all the monetary aspect, the capital flight aspect of what's happening. And the reason I'm so keen about it, obviously, I work in financial technology, so that's sort of my bread and butter. But so maybe I'm just a little bit more sensitive to the idea. But I've noticed two things happened is that the chief executive is what she's called. Her name is Lam, last name L-A-M. And she was the one who put this. It was actually a proposed bill that would allow people who commit crimes to be extradited to the mainland, and it has to do with a murder that occurred. Guy confessed, young guy killed his fiance, pregnant fiance, in Taipei, I guess. And basically, he's a Hong Konger, but they couldn't get it. They couldn't, you know, they had all these legal restrictions between the two, and so this bill was sort of used as the murder was used as an excuse to kind of forward this bill through. And that, of course, led to these protests that we see. She, even with a million people in the street, even with it building and building, building for a couple of weeks, or at least, you know, more than 5 days, she was not backing off of it. She was not coming off of it at all. And then Reuters got a hold of some whales, some guys, what they call tycoons, who were taking their money, because Hong Kong is, again, considered an oasis where you can put your money in the sort of the straight world, the traditional legacy finance world. You can park it in Hong Kong and have it, you know, relatively unmolested. You can make it work for you and so on. The other side of that, in terms of the Asian equation, is Singapore. And so what the tycoons in Hong Kong are doing is saying, F it. Let's just move our hundreds of millions of yuan or renminbi or what, Hong Kong dollars, to Singapore. And once that report came out, in hours, again, we've already had the millions of protesters. And I'm not downing or saying they're insignificant. I'm thinking they're too heavily weighted, I believe, against what really rattles the cage of Beijing and Hong Kong, which is capital flight that you just touched on. And within hours of that report from Reuters coming out, she was like, you know what? You know what, guys? I took another look at this, and I'm gonna go ahead and shelve the extradition bill here. And, you know, c'est la vie. I've heard the voice of the people. I would have now. It was summarily rejected, and there was even a greater protest the following day when 2 million people showed up. So it's not abiding, but I think the point stands, right? That capital flight is a real problem for governments and especially authoritarian regimes, right?
Yeah. If the money leaves, if it flies away, you know, you can't tax it, you can't confiscate it, you can't have it sitting in your state-controlled banks, lending it out to your cronies. So this is why capital flight is an issue, and also, you know, Hong Kong is subjected to the porousness that their free market history sort of enables, is that, you know, they've been the financial oasis. People in Hong Kong are very international and very global. And, you know, it is currently, even without Bitcoin, you know, accessible for people to get large amounts of money out of the country. And while you mentioned some antidotes there, it's hard to kind of pinpoint some data on this, but as far as we can tell, in terms of, let's say, local Bitcoin volumes concerning the Hong Kong dollar, you know, it was averaging around 2 million in the Hong Kong dollar currency, but per day. But then once we start getting close to these protests, we really see a ramp up of about, you know, almost like doubling, tripling, almost quadrupling. And, you know, that's, you can maybe make some sense out of that in terms of, you know, are people, you know, because of these protests, buying more Bitcoin or using it to get money out? It's hard to say. It's hard to say if that, if those things are related or if that's part of this general trend. Even though a few other countries have a little bit different type of charts. And also a lot of people were suggesting that the recent upward price pressure that brought, you know, BTC above 9,000 again, brought BCH above 400,
right,
and, you know, brought the market up a few points, was due to the protests, whether it was a bunch of Hong Kongers buying Bitcoin because of this, or every observer looking at the, you know, the example being set there of government really stepping beyond its bounds and people standing up for their rights and seeing that as a trigger event to actually, hey, I should probably buy some more cryptocurrency to protect my my finances. So, you know, in terms of the data, that's what we can kind of maybe parse out is like, yeah, this is actually occurring. The protests are actually causing a real world impact into the crypto economy. And, you know, it's really interesting to think about, not only from the wealth, you know, fleeing and, you know, safe harboring that, but also what I thought was pretty interesting, which, you know, it's hard to say how much of the percentage was wealth or just people on the ground transacting, you know, money around. But what was really notable was that people were noticing that a lot of the protesters were seen foregoing, I believe it's called the Octopus card.
Yes.
Which is basically the fintech card that allows people to, like, you know, pay for their subway, their metro, their food, whatever, all over Hong Kong. And people were waiting in line to physically pay in cash to get train tickets or whatever it might be in order to obfuscate what they were doing, because there was a fear that, oh, the government's actually going to go into the logs and start pinpointing, you know, where certain people were like going off on the train. And, you know, that must mean that they were a protester, and then, you know, adding that to some secretive file somewhere that a bureaucrat is looking at. So it's interesting to know too, while we saw the bump in, you know, crypto volume, and especially crypto volume concerning the Hong Kong dollar at local Bitcoins, you know, was that also people on the ground saying, hey, I need something that can kind of obfuscate my presence, that I can't be in the world of fintech that is centralized and accessible to the, you know, evil eye of the government. And I need something that can hide my presence a little bit more. And those people that were also paying, you know, for the train tickets in cash, they might have been also buying cryptocurrency to sort of transact amongst themselves, or maybe there were other businesses in the area that were accepting cryptocurrency they were using. So, you know, this is definitely a potentiality that crypto served a significant purpose in actually coordinating and organizing a lot of the protesters that got out there, similar to the way that we saw Telegram being one of the main messaging tools that the protesters were using, and that, you know, all these sort of
decentralized
applications, you know, and coming together to fuel these people and their protests that were demanding more freedom, more sovereignty, and sticking up for their rights.
And that control is something that we in the Bitcoin Cash community especially have sort of been fighting for all along, which is the cash-like properties of cryptocurrency, of Bitcoin in particular, are super important. And the arguments usually always boil down, especially in times when, say, there's not a crisis immediately in front of especially Westerners. And they'll say, well, you know, why do you need all this privacy or the pseudo-anonymity? And, you know, you guys are just ridiculous. You just want to go on Silk Road and slam heroin and buy hookers. And it's hard to overcome that immediate visceral argument because you don't have something so palpable, like right there. And Hong Kong, I think, at least for the moment, has erased that with the example you just said. So there are these magnificent photographs taken by embedded journalists in Hong Kong who are themselves Hong Kongers going about their regular day saying, hey, look, I've not seen lines like this for the octopus card at the train station in forever. And in fact, the octopus card itself was a way to alleviate congestion, at least, you know, the pretext for it. So here it is, people, you know, shoving the card in their back in their wallets or whatever, and going for good old filthy fiat. And that, to me, sent off major signals, major fireworks that, hey, there's something here. And then when the DDoS attacks on Telegram happened, the official company sort of statements, at least on Twitter, as they were rolling out, were, well, you know, it happens. It's just out here. It's interesting enough, it happened in the Americas. And they said, well, you know, this happens, you know, we're working on it, blah, blah, blah. Pavel Durov, the CEO and founder, got right up there and said, okay, we found out that, you know, the IP addresses of attackers are largely coming from China. And so those, if you know anything about cryptocurrency, especially if you're listening to the Peter Ryan Report, you're savvy enough to know that where are crypto people? They, of course, are on Telegram. And, you know, you can do a lot of the math. And again, we have to be careful because, you know, correlation and causation, all that stuff. But I think you've pointed to enough little, you know, if they're not data points, they're also anecdotes, where there's kind of a nexus forming, right? So that it's maybe not a cryptocurrency revolution in particular, but I think the lessons drawn, because each time there are these little outbursts of protest in Hong Kong, people learn a little bit more. So the octopus card being, you know, eschewed for cash was actually a reaction from the first sort of proto protest with regard to what they called the umbrella protests, sort of pro-democracy, people getting out there using umbrellas to mask drones that were flying over trying to get, you know, take pictures. And then when certain friends disappeared, they realized, oh, well, they knew we were at the, because they saw our octopus card. So this time around, they, you know, forewent that and so on. So I think if there's going to be future protests, I think you're going to see that those crypto numbers go up even more. Do you think I'm onto something, or am I just kind of maybe getting a little too over my skis?
The ratcheting of the tension that mainland China places on Hong Kong. And this was also something baked into the cake. I mean, you know, when Imperial England forego their sort of semi-colony of Hong Kong years ago and gave it back, or maybe not gave back is the right term, but gave it over to mainland China. You know, a lot of the predictions about what exactly would become of that relationship are starting to bear fruit. And, you know, in a lot of ways, this was always going to happen. The mainland was always going to integrate Hong Kong one way or the other into their system. And while they can pay lip service to the, you know, the various sort of, oh, well, you know, we respect the two systems, but like one country, right. You know, symbology of that. But, you know, I mean, there were a lot of reports of, you know, well, why can't the mainland sort of secretly help out certain Hong Kong politicians or other people in the government there vicariously to basically create a more preferential treatment towards the mainland that has a more integrationist outlook than one that is a little bit more steadfast in their resolve. Symbology of two systems, one country that goes on. But is that more of lip service that's needed for, you know, PR reasons rather than what ultimately is the intended outcome, which is to vicariously move Hong Kong to the mainland's, you know, system and opinion on matters and find ways to integrate like this extradition bill. You know, these are all things that mainland wants has been baked into the cake since it was handed over from the UK. And this is why Hong Kong has been seen as maybe like very lenient when it comes to cryptocurrencies to begin with. You know, we've seen a lot of dabbling that has gone on there. And they've always been, you know, very open to the outside world and financial innovation in that sense. So as the tension ratchets and these protests perhaps get worse, or there could be further government actions and laws that are very dissatisfying to the population there, you could see more crypto adoption. You could see people thinking, okay, so like one, this is a vehicle for me to move my money that is outside the purview of any legacy system that perhaps a government bureaucrat could oversee, whether they can stop that money from moving or not. They can certainly know that a particular individual moved that money. But even though we have all the tracking services in the world when it comes to Bitcoin nowadays, there is still that level of privacy that it can support on the surface level. And with all the tools that are being developed, like Cash Shuffle and all the rest, it is becoming easier and easier to really anonymize yourself using crypto. And yeah, we can really see that as a benefit for these people to kind of to move out, especially if a lot of them also see the value in actually staying in it and transacting more and more in whatever cryptocurrency they deem to be most preferential.
And I think too, there's we should probably add that there's kind of a danger of two go-go American free marketers, you know, kind of cheering or grave dancing on anything remotely anti-communist, that we have to be kind of careful because Xi and, you know, they no longer walk around in pea green suits with, you know, stupid little, you know, books and talk that communist jibber jab, at least publicly to the West. They're very business oriented. They're very trade oriented. They have a stock market, which, you know, say what you want about it. You know, that was a requirement, say Mises had, of, you know, what's the difference between a, you know, straight socialist society and a more free market oriented one, which would be, of course, his minimum litmus was to have some kind of market, stock market or speculative market. There's a lot of good that's happening in China that is maybe beneath the surface, so that it's got to keep this ruse of social control. And almost in a way, I'm not sure how to phrase this, but it almost may be too jarring to mainland folks in the West, because to go overnight from, you know, we're going to take care of you cradle to grave to, you know, now you fend for yourself and hopefully you too can find a well-tailored suit. Like, I think that jump is, you know, kind of giant. Whereas what they're trying to do, if George Gilder has written quite a bit about this, and he's about as capital as you can get, he has talked about the movement of China to a market system, and that it is, for all intents and purposes, you know, probably going to be very soon the largest, ironically, free market system in the world. So, you know, we have to be careful as Westerners that, you know, our biases don't show too much here, that, you know, we acknowledge both what we like, which is sort of the pushback and, you know, some sort of a tendency towards individualism and privacy-oriented cash-like crypto movement, and not, on the one hand, acknowledge some very real, you know, change, right?
Yeah, and there's certainly aspects of mainland China that are market-oriented when it comes to the special economic zones, when it comes to, you know, some of their efforts at modernizing, when it comes to, again, sort of the history of what you could say more as independent city-states, as Hong Kong, Shanghai sort of represent, you know, a more outward-facing demeanor than, you know, what you could imagine Beijing or some of the interior of the country is like, that stems some of more of that communist sentiment. But to just push back on, like, you know, China being the free market oasis, you know, China is a country that has, you know, really only four banks controlled by the state, and those banks are basically shelling loan after loan out, backed by the government. Whether,
well, if you're going to give them,
yeah, yeah. So, you know, as maybe on certain local levels or in certain very precise geographies where, you know, Apple is allowed to make its iPhone using, you know, we're not gonna talk about how certain demographics of people in China became subsistence laborers. But whatever you want to say about that portion, the overwhelming portion of China is fueled by state-backed debt that is just exploding at a level that is really never before seen. And what some analysts are suggesting, that it's, you know, it is basically an Obama stimulus package every single month that is being injected into the Chinese economy. And granted, they're a bigger population, but at the same time, they are not the same level of economic development even now that the United States is.
Yeah, that's a good point. That it may actually be overstated in the other direction. But I wanted to at least, you know, put something in there for our communist listeners here. But in any case,
those good commies. They love a free podcast, don't they?
I think this is going to be the last Peter Ryan report. He's done with me. Oh, my God. Anyway, yeah, that's hilarious. The basic idea here is that I think we can agree these are good signs that when a population feels comfortable enough to go out and voice their concerns, and that seems to coincide with some movement towards economic freedom, that both of those happenings are pluses for bullish signs for cryptocurrency adoption ultimately.
Yeah, yeah. And if I can conclude with just one data point here, you know, let's think about these protesters and what they represent. You know, reports have been that about one in seven Hong Kongers participated in these protests. There's about, let's say, 7 million people in Hong Kong. The average net worth of someone in Hong Kong is about $250,000. You take one out of seven, that's a million people. You think about it from the point of view, 1% of their net worth, let's say they allocate it to crypto, we're talking about $2.5 billion that has the potential to hit the crypto markets. If these people that were so enraged to get out in the street and risk their, you know, their livelihoods, their safety, their security, to voice this dissent, you know, it's very likely that those people also in the, you know, solace of their home office or computer room, or, you know, just wherever they are on their mobile phone, decide to go to their preferred crypto exchange and buy some crypto.
All right, man. Well, appreciate you coming on and another great Peter Ryan report. Where can people find your work?
Yeah, people can follow me at Twitter, at underscore Peter Ryan. That's where you can find some great stuff. I tweet quite a bit, charts, data, reporting of the industry, some really cool memes, stuff like that. Also, recently launched, you can follow me at ryanresearch.co. It's my new research firm, and we'll be reporting on mainly cryptocurrency as well as other cutting-edge technologies. You can find articles, videos, podcasts that I've been on, and you can soon find in-depth and data-driven reports on there that cover the gamut when it comes to what's going on in this industry. And always, please, subscribe to my newsletter when you get there.
You're listening to the Peter Ryan Report on Coinspice.io. You're listening to the Peter Ryan Report on Coinspice.io. You're listening to the Peter Ryan Report on Coinspice.io.